The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. This podcast episode may have ads and the occasional announcement. To listen without ads or announcements and take advantage of a host of other benefits, consider becoming a premium subscriber. Visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's T-E-C-H for more information. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Enrique Abeta, welcome back to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. This is, I believe, your third visit. Things have changed a bit, however. You are now the founder and CEO of 8X Research, the website 8xresearch.net. We're going to talk about that in a minute, but I want to kick off with your big picture views about markets and the economy as we record this on March 29th, 2024. The first quarter is officially over, but over to you because your views are constructive, and I want to let you explain why.
Yeah. Well, first off, thank you. I think this might be my fourth time. I'm not quite sure.
It could be.
But it's always a pleasure, Nat. I think that it's sexy to be contrarian.
Oh, yes.
It is very sexy, honestly. The reality is you make most of your money from the trends. You know, a stock going from 10 to 20 to 50 to 100 is a trend. And, you know, I think that also the majority of the time, and I'm going really high level here, but then I'm going to get into some very specific stuff. The majority of the time, the market goes up because the economy is productive. You know, everyone's trying to make the economy go up and have companies grow and grow earnings. So guess what? 70% of the time, that's what happens. Now, what happens also is I think that a lot of people don't have enough respect for trends and what they mean. And the example I use, I love to use examples with the ocean. And, you know, in the ocean, we have tides. And tides are these underlying powerful things that are literally driven by the moon, by planets, et cetera. You can't necessarily see them, but you can feel them. And so I think when you get into the stock market, you see trends. You can see a downward trend as we did in 2022, a sideways trend as we see some periods, and an upwards trend. And there's a funny thing that goes very against contrarian thinking, but strength begets strength. So with the close of March, we've actually closed our fifth month in a row where the S&P 500 was up 1% or more. Okay. Now, in the past 75 years, that's a very rare occurrence. It's only happened 12 times. So think about how many rolling we've had, whatever, 75 times 12. We've had 900 occurrences. 1% of the time, this happens. And when you look at the stock market, and I posted this on my Twitter, I think yesterday, and I'm writing a note about it, you know, next week, is, and by the way, this information is from Bespoke Investment Group, which is a fantastic group that does a lot of, you know, technical macro stuff. But when you see the market go up, S&P 1%, the 12 times we've seen it, in the near term, in the next month, the market is actually down about 43% of the time. Now, that's against the market any given month being down 40% of the time. So it's a little bit worse. But when you go out 3, 6, 12 months, the market in those previous 12 times was up 12 out of 12 6 months later and 11 of 12 12 months later. And the one time it was down, and I don't have the table in front of me, I think it was down like a percent or something 12 months later. So my point is, you know, I look for rarities. I look for things that don't happen very often. Most of the time, the market technicals aren't really telling you anything. Most of the time, the 99% of the time, the market doesn't go up 1% or more 5 months in a row. That's literally a fact. So when we do have something rare happened, I pay attention to that. And what this is speaking to is the strength of the underlying dynamics. Now, most people would come at it and say, okay, well, what's driving those dynamics? Interest rates, liquidity, you know, money moving out of money market funds. The answer is yes. And it's all of those things. I don't know which one is more important, but what I do know is that price and trends give me that information. And so what I'd say, I'll kind of sum up my market view, is in the short term, I'm moderately concerned about a pullback. And, you know, I'll just give you an idea. You know, the S&P right now has been really extended from the 50-day moving average for a while. Now we could talk about why that's important. The S&P is at 52.45. The moving average is at 50.40. That would be a 4% pullback. NVIDIA is 15% above its 50-day moving average. You know, I think that we're going to see a period before year end where we pull back to those moving averages. That either means A, the market stops going up and lets the moving average catch up, or B, the market goes down some. I think that's very likely in the next few months. But if you told me for year end, I mean, this indicator is so rare. I have in my IRA, I have what I call the tactical trading account. I only do big macro trades, super, super levered. I'm actually considering taking a third or half of my IRA and buying end of year call options on the S&P 500. I usually only do that when it's super oversold, but that's how strongly these technical indicators are. And I gave you that one. If you go to my Twitter, I've thrown up dozens of these, you know, a 10% quarter, you know, just all these different things. So yeah, I'm probably as high confidence constructive into year end as you'll ever see me in my 30-year history in the markets. So how about that?
What kind of strike price would you be looking for on the S&P?
Hell if I know. I mean, higher is the answer. Okay. I mean, if you go to the data, let me see if I can actually pull it up on my Twitter. If you go to the data and look at the returns. So the other thing is, I mentioned that the returns are higher 100% of the time going out 93% of the time 12 months later. The returns are actually higher than the normal return. Here's actually the numbers, okay? In 6 months forward, the stock market, the S&P 500, is usually up 69% of the time, and it's up 4.33. In the 12 occurrences that have happened previously, it was up 91.7, and it was up 6.87%, so up 50% more. In the 12-month, I got them mixed up. The 12-month, it's 100% hit rate versus a normal 12-month hit rate of 72.7. Okay. And the average return for the 12-month is 14.28 versus a normal 8.77. Yeah. So, you know, look, here's the deal. Anything could happen. A nuke could go off. You know, I don't know. I don't know if there's going to be another COVID. You know, so nothing's ever 100%. But, you know, if we're using blackjack terms, man, you know, we're sitting on a great hand. We need to be splitting and doubling down right now from a top-down view. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, I've had maybe 10 times I've felt this way in 30 years about the overall market, because most of my time I spend picking stocks and picking trades. But yeah, I look, this is probably a contrarian view. Someone who is that confident, and we'll see if I regret this. But I'm just going by the data. I'm just going by the data and what's out there. So
yeah, and this is based on the S&P being up 5 months in a row. Is that right? That's the underlying.
What I'm saying is, I used that as one highlight. Again, if you go to my Twitter, you can see I've got a dozen. So let's do it two ways: quasi technical, kind of capturing the trend. I have dozens and dozens of indicators that are all saying the same thing. Some of them have to do, but they all have to do with the consistency of positive return, okay? And relatively low volatility, as well as the level of overbought. Just indicator after indicator after indicator saying we go higher. But then you take a step back and you say, well, with interest rates, Do I think they're going up 500 basis points, down 500 basis points, or downish or upish? Well, I'll go with downish, maybe a little upish. So it's a non-thing. You know, with commodities, yeah, they maybe move a little bit higher. GDP growth, we're in a productive economy. So it's not like we're unraveling portions of the economy, you know. So the macro scenario, so what I'm saying is that there's a good chance the market's up 10% from here by year end. Actually, well, I'll go on record this. I think the market's lower first and then is up from these levels, double digits from here, 10, 12%. The macro view, you know, it's supportive. It lends itself to that as well. So the technicals are more important to me, to be honest, because it's just data. It's probability. I mean, it's just blackjack, you know. And the funny thing is, in blackjack, you can have that hand that you should be splitting and doubling down, and you can still lose. But Here's the point: you need to make that bet. And I think being constructive in a year end on the broad S&P 500 right now is a bet is a good bet. Is an excellent bet.
Okay, fair. Now, just to put into these things into question a tiny little bit, if I may. The technicals, it's basically you're basing this on past performance. It's not quite like blackjack because there's only however many cards in it. How many cards are there in the deck? 52?
Well, no, it is exactly like blackjack because if you're counting cards in blackjack, which is what we're doing here, past performance is an indicator of future performance.
Yeah, because there's only finite number of cards in a deck.
Exactly.
But so here, there's unlimited variables in what might happen.
I disagree. Here's a variable that's not going to happen. The Fed is not going to go out and raise interest rates 500 basis points in the next 9 months. That's a variable that's not going to happen. Oil is not going to 20 in the next 9 months.
Probably
okay.
Not.
I fundamentally disagree with your premise.
Yeah, but there's a lot that can still change. Like you can have a COVID event. Like you mentioned it. You know, you can have COVID. Again, you can have something in the Middle East. You can have Russia. You can have
Yes. What happened the last Russia event? What happened the last Middle East event? And how many COVIDs have we had?
One.
So again, it gets down to probability. I absolutely refuse. This is why so many investors fail is they don't respect the trend. They look at the price data as independent trials, and they're absolutely wrong. They need to look at the price data and understand that price data at points can give them a much better probability of understanding what happens next. So past performance is absolutely a predeterminant of future performance sometimes.
Okay. Sometimes I believe. All right. And it gets easier, obviously, in the short term.
So, I'm giving us, I guess, what are we?
Medium.
9 month view?
Yeah. I mean, there's fewer things that can happen in 9 months than there are in 9 years.
Yeah. Look, I'll tell you this. My 9 year view is the market's going to be a fuck ton higher just because the world's awesome, you know? So, but I don't always have this clarity. Like
sick of me yet? Become a premium subscriber and avoid all ads or interruptions. Other benefits as well. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Yeah, well, no, I'm telling you this. There's probably 10 times in 30 years where I felt that the data lined up this way, but we're in one of those 10 times.
Yeah. We've had the last couple podcasts have been financial historians that have come on. And it's always a fun game to play. What era are we living in now? You talked on it before we started recording, but do you think, or is it like the 90s a bit, about in the good 90s, the mid 90s?
It feels a lot like the 90s. I mean, people forget, you know, I started my career, I graduated from Wharton in the early 90s, started in private equity, but started in the buy side in 96. You know, we, since the internet bubble, have been used to this schizophrenic Fed action. Okay, rates are at 400. Now we got to cut 400 basis points to save the economy. Well, now we got to raise it because the economy is overheated. The reality is, in the previous 20 years, so if you go from 1980 to 2000, that's not really what happened. is the economy was doing fine and it would heat up a little bit and then they cut, then they'd raise a little bit, then it'd slow down, then they cut a little bit, you know, all these different things. And I'm actually going to write a note about it here in my, so I have a free daily publication, HX Daily, daily.hxresearch.net. It's, you know, it's probably about 1,000 words, comes out every business day. And there's a review on Saturdays. I'm going to write one where I basically compare this period to 1995, where, you know, the schizophrenic Fed, which is also, I know, a note I wrote a couple of months ago, is the exception, not the norm. So, you know, look, I think that economic growth will be okay. I think the Fed will cut some, raise some, you know, it won't be a real disruptor. I think inflation will be higher than it used to be, but lower than it's been recently, you know, and kind of go there. And you know, look, there is something called the norm, and we dealt with it. By the way, I'll also say this, people forget, from 2013 to 2019 was a very, 2017 was one of the lowest volatility years in the 70-year history of the S&P 500. So it's not like when I talk about 95 that I'm going to like some ancient history. I'm just telling you we could have a year of something that happened 8 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true that we have kind of become conditioned to these drastic moves by the Fed and things like, you know, and extreme policies like zero interest rate policies and even negative interest rates, not here, but in Japan, which they've since abandoned. Yeah, well, but when it comes to the Fed, yeah, and do you think, I mean, it would shock the market if they raised rates here at all, yeah, or even if they didn't cut. And do you think that's a possibility at all? Or do you think
I don't look. So I'll say a couple things about the Fed. And again, I'm a math guy or I'm a data guy. I think this was bespoke, but it might have been someone else put out some great data about what the Fed does in election years. We would like to think the Fed is not political, but the fact is in presidential election years, the Fed is like 30 to 50% less likely to make any changes. If they can sit on their hands, they sit on their hands. And I think that the market we're in sort of lends itself to that. You know, it's like they don't need to be aggressive one way or the other. And I think we have a fine balance of productivity, but then employment. You know, let's just take the idea of productivity, inflation, and employment. This is a perfect example. You know, in theory, AI will increase productivity, which should be good for inflation, meaning it should subdue inflation, but it also may increase unemployment. Well, now I'm like, okay, well, that's maybe why we should cut. But AI could also accelerate growth. Well, that's maybe why we should raise. So, you know, look, I my contrarian view is shit's going to be boring the rest of the year. No one wants to talk about that. What happens if the market between here and now, the Fed cuts 1 to 3 times, you know, commercial real estate doesn't collapse. We can talk a lot about that because I'm very close to that. You know, the military stuff stays in the same detente that it's been and, you know, and probably is going to persist it for quite some time. And the market has some corrections, but grinds higher. And there's some new innovation, GLP-1s, you know, whatchamacallit. And there's pockets of stupidity, insanity, DWAC, DJT or whatever, Trump Digital or whatever it's called now. You know, some of the stuff that happens. But you know what? That market looks like 2017. That's what that was. You know, looks like 1995. Yeah. And those were both those years off the top of my head. I actually haven't pulled up. Let me pull up S&P 500. I actually think 95 was a really good year. So, yeah, my contrarian view is I think it's going to be a boring up year. How about
that? Okay. Let's talk about commercial real estate. They've been talking now for some time.
Can I pause for 1 second?
Yeah,
so 2017, the S&P 500 was up 19.42%. And in 1995, the S&P 500 was up 34.11. Year to date, the S&P 500 is up 10. So I would point to 95 and 2017 as the two years. By the way, in 2017, we were raising interest rates.
Yeah.
And in 1995, let me just pull up this Fed funds from Bloomberg. Actually, in 95, they raised rates a little bit.
They did.
Yeah. Yeah. They did the same thing they did in 2017. So
and then 96 you know, came his famous irrational exuberance speech, and then 98 yep. LTCM they cut.
Actually, yes. Well, the Thai bot in 97 is actually when they right. when they first cut. Just see, so you know, because I was there, I was actively yeah, I trading as a portfolio manager. So, anyways, commercial real estate.
So yeah, so you're not worried about it because we've heard now, you know, horror stories for ever since COVID, right? About how these leases are going to become due. No one's going to fill the place, and going to have ripple effects. Blah blah blah.
So I have a buddy who, without outing him, Wharton classmate of mine, worked at one of the largest and most famous REITs of all time, then went and started a business for one of the largest real estate business for one of the largest brokerages, then founded the real estate business at another one of the most famous hedge funds of all time. And has his own business. He deploys, I don't know, 15, 20 billion. So I go to him. He sees everything. He was bidding on the Silicon Valley Bank assets, et cetera. I actually wrote a note about this about 3 weeks ago. I took my entire conversation with him. And this is what he said. He goes, you know, there's two things to consider. The first is that commercial real estate is a very big market. We all like to think of commercial real estate and think of Class A, B, and C office buildings in urban and suburban markets. Well, while those are very high profile, that's only about 15-20% of the total market. There's warehouses, there's all kinds of other office space, there's all these different things. So his point is, it looks really, again, sexy when this building that sold for 200 million sells for, or your 500 million sells for 200 million, but in aggregate, it's a small part of the market. But this other point is the more important one, and much, much more important, is I think sometimes people with a short bias, and I was, by the way, I spent 70% of my time on the short side when I was a professional money manager. They forget that there's other people on the other side of the equation who don't want the outcome. So you know who doesn't want all this real estate to go upside down? The people who made the loans, the banks. They have no interest in doing it. Do you know who else doesn't want it to happen? The bank regulators. You know who else doesn't want to have it happen? The Fed. So we have and you know who else doesn't want to have it happen? The people who own the damn buildings. Yeah. So, you know, this isn't Carl Icahn corporate finance that the banks are sitting there and can't wait to get these buildings. It's exactly the opposite. I saw there was an article, maybe it was in the Wall Street Journal the other day, about like, you know, you actually had an owner of a building was going to do a workout and the banks refused to let him do it. They refinanced him instead. So we can argue whether this is kicking the can or not. I don't necessarily think it is, because I think that the can is just one can of many. You know, it's one of 20 cans. And, you know, we forget that there's a group of people out there, that everyone involved in this process, that doesn't want it to happen. So, you know, I think that unless it has such momentum, you know, the housing crisis in 2008, where there was no one to stop it, you know, there was no one on the other side too that could say, oh, I'm just not going to collect these. This is a much different market. So are there issues? Are they real? Absolutely. Are they likely to be what takes the market down? I don't think they are. And you know, when the banks went, when Silicon Valley happened last year, we went in at my old firm and we bought every single bank we could lay our hands on, which hurt us in one of them. We lost money in First Republic, but we had 16 other picks in our trading franchise. We made money on the other 15. So net, we actually made pretty good money. One of my points was, you forget that there's people on the other side of the equation that also control these mechanisms. I actually wrote a note, which I republished here because of what happened with NYCB. Yeah. I said the system is rigged, and it's rigged to survive. So, you know, I think commercial real estate looks real sexy, but I think when you actually go through and do the numbers and understand the system, it doesn't add up. It doesn't make any sense. But I'll tell you, this isn't me trying to be a smart guy. This is me talking to that buddy, talking to another buddy who runs there's like six families that own like massive amounts of New York real estate. He runs their office. I have a half a dozen guys that I go to, that I went to school with, who manage probably between them, I've never done this number, over $100 billion in commercial real estate. There's no doubt about it. And I asked them, and right now I got to tell you, they're all saying the same thing. I'm not that worried about it. Maybe that's contrarian too. How about that?
Yeah, that is contrarian. And you like New York NYCB?
No, I wouldn't touch NYCB with a 10-foot pole. I don't have it. But you know what? But that's a strong, I don't have an opinion on NYCB.
Okay.
That's actually what I'd say about NYCB. I think the NYCB situation was very particular to NYCB for two reasons. The book of business that they have on the loan side is very New York heavy. It's also very B and C class in major urban markets. They are unique with the level of exposure they have to that. Yeah. There's no other bank in the country that has that. The second thing is, remember, NYCB, when they bought Signature, went through $100 billion. So they're actually their whole problem, if they had still been under the rules under $100 billion, the quarter, they don't have to do any of the shit that they did in the, or they don't have to do a lot of the stuff they did in the quarter. So I think NYCB, but we went out in my trading and we don't talk about, so we have my business. Let me just explain this real quick. We have a free daily newsletter. We have a podcast, the HX podcast, which is also free on all the podcast networks and YouTube. And then we have three paid products. We have two trading products, HX Trader and HX Income, which are equities and options that are trading oriented. So it sort of churns out returns. We made money in 22. You know, it's relatively short term, meaning 60 days. And then we have HX Legacy, which is my old hedge fund strategy, looks out multiple years. We're looking for multi-baggers. Okay. In my trading strategies, we actually went out and bought four or five banks off the back of NYCB, just like we did last year. We're about to take profits on the first one of them this week. Okay. So I'm constructive on the regional banks. I just think NYC is a big do-nothing at this point.
Interesting. Okay. Let me see. Should we take a break and come back with some more stock talk, or let's do that. Yeah, let's take a quick break. If you are a premium subscriber, you will not get the break, so don't touch the dial. We'll be right back. In fact, we already are. And to become a premium subscriber, be sure to visit the website, contrarianpod.substack.com, and sign up. It includes the Daily Contrarian, which is a morning look at what is likely to move markets in the day ahead. Check it out. And we'll be right back.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. Consider becoming a premium subscriber. For $9 a month or less, premium subscribers receive a number of benefits. Podcasts are posted immediately after they're recorded. Transcripts are made available within 24 hours. Premium subscribers get direct access to the host, and of course, there are no ads or interruptions. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
By the way, you don't need the .tech suffix to get to that website. .com will do the trick. And we also have a Substack that you can, where you can sign up for the same prices, same benefits, same details. contrarianpod.substack.com. So if you already have a Substack account and use it, or have the app and use that, that's probably the best way to go. So contrarian.supercast.com or contrarianpod.substack.com, whole bunch of benefits, including, of course, getting this episode up to a week early without ads or annoying announcements. And you also get the Daily Contrarian briefing and podcast that is released every market day morning at 7 a.m. This is a contrarian take on the events of the day ahead and what is likely to move markets, such as economic data releases, earnings, and other things. It is really good, and that is completely unbiased, of course. So check that out. contrarianpod.substack.com or contrarian.supercast.tech. Now on with the show.
Welcome back, everybody. Here with Enrique Abeta, hxresearch.net. Let's talk stock. Now, there's one pretty big AI chip maker you may have heard of called NVIDIA, stock ticker NVDA. What's your views on that?
You know, look, I've been involved in NVIDIA. I'm trying to think since it went public. You know, remember that NVIDIA began as a video game chip company.
Right.
I've been involved since it came public. I did a lot in the video game space in the late 90s, early 2000s. We actually went out and at my prior firm, Empire, put a big recommendation out in the year 2020. And, you know, our view was that the world was changing and the amount of compute that was going to be needed was going to grow asymptotically. You know, that's exponential on steroids. And, you know, that this company was uniquely positioned to take advantage of that. We're on record with that, you know, was one of our biggest calls, et cetera. We ended up being much more right than we ever expected to be. I don't know that, you know, especially a year ago. And, you know, it's funny when people talk about NVIDIA. NVIDIA's gone up for one reason and one reason only. Earnings have gone up. And I wrote a note about this in HX Daily. If you go to, again, daily.hxresearch.net, you can go through the notes and you'll see the title NVIDIA on a couple of them. You know, last May when they beat numbers, since then earnings expectations have gone from $6 for this year to 24, and lo and behold, the stock has gone from 300 to 900. So, you know, it's pretty much in line. So, look, I think NVIDIA is an awesome company. I think they're right on top of a ton of great trends. I think it has a great future, but I don't love the stock right here. Yeah. And I'll tell you the two things that give me concern. You know, from a technical standpoint, and I do pay a lot of attention to technicals per our previous conversation, price gives you information. You know, stocks that go asymptotic don't correct by going sideways. They usually correct by going down and back towards those moving averages. That's not a discussion about the fundamentals of NVIDIA. That's a discussion of the psychology and liquidity of the stock. And as I said here, you know, a little bit earlier, the 50-day moving average is at 770. The stock's at 905. That's $135 from here. That's a 15% move. So, you know, I want this to soak in. The stock, because momentum investors get bored and move on to DJT and SMCI and all these other things, could correct 15% to its 50-day moving average. And we can talk about why moving average is important. And it would still be an awesome chart and an awesome trend. That's technical. The thing that actually concerns me a little bit more with NVIDIA in the intermediate term is Corning and Cisco. And I remember in the late 90s, and everyone knows about Cisco, but let's talk about Corning. Okay. Do you remember Corning, the company? It was the glass company. Okay.
Yeah.
In the late 90s, we were in a period of time, and it's very similar to this. It's a great analogy where people are saying, oh, the internet's going to come. The internet wasn't really there, but the internet was going to come. And in order to power the internet, you had to build the networks. And those networks were predicated on fiber optics, on glass. So at the time, the big stocks, yeah, the internet stocks did real well. By the way, the telecommunications companies, AT&T, all the European things, I mean, they just went up. Incredible. I mean, I think AT&T, all those stocks are still 50% below the all-time highs that they back in 2000. But there was another class of stocks that were selling the picks and shovels. And everyone talks about Cisco, but they forget about Corning. Corning literally sold the fiber optic cable. And so one of the signs that the market was getting overheated is that, and you saw this for both Cisco and Corning, is that you were hearing stories that in the secondary market, people were paying 2, 3, 4, 5 times the list price for equipment. Okay. Now on the face of that, you go, well, that's really bullish, right? That means there's a lot of demand. It is bullish. But the problem is there's then a very high incentive for the companies to make more capacity, to make more equipment. You know, obviously, if the economics were there, and we could talk about the NVIDIA chips, if the economics are there at $10,000, $20,000 a chip, and they're selling for $40,000 in the secondary market, well, I don't think NVIDIA is going to raise their prices. What I think NVIDIA is going to do is they're going to make more chips, as is AMD, as is Intel, as is everyone. So, you know, this is equipment, ultimately. So that doesn't mean, and there's a reason why equipment companies historically have gotten lower multiples, because there is a degree of cyclicality in these. And I think we're dealing with a lot of investors right now who, I wouldn't even tell you that Corning is a company. They don't remember any of this. They're looking at the earnings revisions. They're looking at the company crushing it. And look, they'll probably continue to do that for a period of time. But I'm going to tell you, let's go to my blackjack. You know, you're at this point with NVIDIA, I think you're playing a mediocre hand at best. You know, in the short term, I don't like the technicals. Everyone knows the stock and is talking about it. And I got to tell you, with equipment, like NVIDIA is building more capacity. Everyone in the world is building more capacity. People are buying as much capacity as they get. I'm going to contrast it with the free idea that we just put out, because I can compare and contrast, you know, supply, because we'll just say demand is going to continue to grow, with an area of buying something where there isn't more capacity coming on and it can't come on. But so on NVIDIA, you know, yeah, I would not own the stock right here. Maybe I would own it on a pullback, but I think it's a very dangerous stock. And I just think it's the high probability bet in NVIDIA is probably played through. So I'm less interested in the game at this point.
Okay. But there is something that you are more interested in. You touched on it. And tell me about that idea.
Yeah. So just so you know, what we do, we have incredible support from our subscribers, our free subscribers, everyone that interacts with me on Twitter. I'm Enrique Abeto, one word is my handle on Twitter. But we have fantastic paid subscribers. They're the ones who pay the bills, you know, all of this. I've got a great team. You know, this is my life, this business. And so we don't give away free ideas very often, because out of respect for our paid subscribers, they pay thousands and thousands of dollars to get these ideas. But we usually have one trading idea and one long-term idea out there. And the long-term idea we have out there right now is a company called Talen Energy Corporation, ticker TLNE, okay? It is an independent power producer, which is a fancy way of saying they own power plants. The company has a very interesting history. And in the case of this one, I'm just going to cut to the chase. They own a big nuke. They own the sixth largest nuclear power plant in the country. It's called Susquehanna. It went online in 1983. It's down in Pennsylvania. Now, the company has a very interesting history. And one of the things that excites us about this stock is you, as a viewer, can go out and buy the stock, but most institutions can't buy the stock today. And here's why. Is the company was created when PPL, the old Pennsylvania Power and Light, took a bunch of their generation assets and combined them with a private equity company called Riverstone. They put them into a company and they took that company public, I want to say in 2017, okay, but with a lot of debt on it. And it was the nuke plus a whole bunch of other stuff. That company eventually went bankrupt right after COVID. And the reason was they had all this debt. They kind of made bad bets. And at the time, power demand was kind of, you know, power supply and demand were pretty well balanced. Okay. So the company went upside down. But then it went through this basically prepackaged bankruptcy and emerged last, let me pull up the chart. I think it was last May in what are called the pink sheets. Okay. Yeah. And what that means, and again, you know this stuff, Nat, but a lot of viewers might not, is that to be listed on an exchange, New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, I don't even know if the American Stock Exchange is still around, but they usually have requirements about certain things you have to have done in the previous years. Going bankrupt usually knocks you out of those. So there's an over-the-counter market. That's where TLNE listed. And the stock listed, yeah, it's back in June, let's see here. I'm pulling up the chart. Yeah, right at the beginning of June, it listed at $45 a share. Stock's at $95 today. And it's the simplest story on earth, okay, at this point. When it came out, they redid all the debt, and they got a much better position on the debt. And a couple things happened. I'm going to go to two important things. The first is the company had a jumble of assets. They had the big nuke, which is about 50, 60% of the generation. They had a bunch of other generation assets, gas, coal, et cetera. And then they owned a data center business. They had this litigation with PPL, et cetera. Well, what I'm going to tell you is in the last month, They settled the litigation. They sold the data center business to Amazon. We're going to come back to that in a second. And they cleaned it up. So the company's a pure play. You got this big nuke and a couple other generation assets. The other thing that happened is in the ever so inappropriately named Inflation Reduction Act under Biden, which I will tell you, I'm actually a pretty constructive on that act. I just think the name is terrible. There was a provision that put tax credits for nuclear operators. And the idea was, just like Talon went bankrupt, they wanted to promote people to actually maintain nuclear energy because it is the greenest energy, consistent energy on the planet. It's certainly the cheapest. And if you go, I have a free report at daily.hxresearch.net. You'll see we go through all these, all the numbers and all the stuff. So that basically put a floor of $44 a megawatt hour that no matter for 10 years, no matter what Talon does, and by the way, Talon's cost to produce is $22. So they have a $22 profit no matter what happens. Okay. So that's all very cool. And like, as it goes from the pink sheets and they finish these deals, you know, it's the leverage has come down, you know, it's all going to clean up. But here's where it gets exciting is we are on the verge of an absolute power crisis in this country. Brownouts and blackouts are coming. And I don't know whether they're coming this summer, but they're coming soon. And here's the reason why. Supply is absolutely being constrained. So let's go back to NVIDIA. NVIDIA makes a lot of money making chips. You know what they do? They build another chip fab. Look at how many chip fabs are beyond from Arizona. Chip fabs are being built in Arizona, Ohio, New York, you know, all this different stuff. Go out and try to build a nuke. Okay. Go out and try to get a natural gas, super clean, inexpensive. Try to get a natural gas power plant going. Try to get a coal plant. The only thing you can get provisioned is solar and wind, but there's intermittency, et cetera. So supply is absolutely constrained. Okay. And they own the cheapest supply out there, but demand is accelerating. And it's accelerating in a big way. And it's accelerating because the economy continued to grow. The internet continued to grow. What we saw the reshoring, which is real. We're seeing a lot of industrial movement here. And again, I'll give credit to Biden. I actually think Trump also. Trump and Biden did a big portion of that. EVs playing it has an impact. Okay, that's playing. You know, we need electricity for those damn cars. But now it's AI. And so we initiated on the stock for my paid subscribers. Stock was about 68. On the end of February, they announced a deal. Remember I said they had a data center business? AWS went in and bought their data center. They had a data center right next to the nuke. They paid double what they spent on the data center. But AWS did two other things. They said, we're going to triple the data center, and we're going to go out, and we're going to pay you $70 a megawatt hour for the power for the data center. Power in that market trades at $45 right now. Okay. And premium. So what I think we're going to see a land grab. I have it on good authority from a buddy of mine that one of the major tech companies that runs the data centers went to one of the major nuke companies. And there's only a couple of these. There's Constellation, which is the big one, Vistra, and then Talon, which is like the tiny little pure play. And they said, we want to buy 50% of your nuclear capacity for the next 30 years. And they offered to pay double what they were selling for it for right now. That company said, I can't do that. Like, I can't spare the capacity. But I think that, you know, let's talk about the power crisis. You're going to see demand go like this because of all these reasons we talked about. Sorry, it's on a camera. So it goes like this. and supply is going to stick like this. And the problem with commodity markets is they don't go up linearly. It's not that we clear the market at 50 and then now we have more demand and we go to 55 and oh, everything's great. They go asymptotic again. So power prices don't go from, look at natural gas in Europe, like, you know, a couple of years ago. It doesn't go from 10 to 20, it goes from 10 to 200. So with Talon in particular, this is true of Constellation and Vistra as well, you kind of have a free look. They make power at 22. They get a minimum of 45 because of the damn government. And now if power goes from 45 to 150, they make a bunch of money. Now, yes, they have capacity that's out there and all that. But, you know, we're going to do an update note here in this coming week where we actually go through some of the numbers. And look, the numbers are pretty easy. Is I think that the company, you know, today it has a market cap, just hit a new 52-week high yesterday, market cap of $5.6 billion. It's got $1.7 billion of net debt. That's $7.3 billion. Of enterprise value. Right now they're saying they're going to do $750 million of EBITDA. So you're looking at about 10 times EBITDA, EV to EBITDA. I think they're going to blow away that number. I think it's very reasonable to think that they could do $1.25 billion of EBITDA because every single dollar. So let's do one thing. Every megawatt hour is a dollar per megawatt hour is worth $15 for them. So if we go to the Amazon levels, that's the Amazon levels, $70 versus where we are now. That's $25 times 15 is 375. We'll add that to 800, $1.175 billion. So at $1.25 billion of EBITDA, Constellation trades at 15 times. I think this will trade there, but let's go 1.25. Let's put it at 12 and a half times. That's $15.63 billion. I subtract out my $1.7 billion of debt because my debt doesn't go up anymore. And I'm looking at a $240 share, $237 share price. Stocks at 94.
Wow.
94. Okay. But here's my point is like you want an AI play. This is an AI play. There's a floor. And so the last part of this, I don't think we ever see 230. You want to know why? I think Constellation before year end comes in, offers 15 or 20 times EBITDA, current EBITDA, and they buy the thing for $150, $175 a share. And the reason is, there's a lot of reasons, but Constellation actually owns a sister plant about 150 miles away. Same design. It's in Pennsylvania. It's the same plant. So they have huge cost synergies, and I think they're going to go in and offer to buy it. Hmm. The other thing, and I'll throw this out there, I think you might see Amazon or Microsoft in the next year to 3 years go out and try to buy one of these new companies. You know, go out and try to buy Constellation, go out and try to buy Vistra. I don't think they try to buy Talon because it's too small. I think they're going to go, but you know, when these things do it, I'm saying on the fundamentals, I can support 230. It could go to 300 on that kind of stuff, but who cares? The government's paying my bills. I make $22 a megawatt hour, no matter what happens, thanks to Joe Biden. So
at some point, wouldn't they want to bring new nukes online? If it, you know, I know that it's politically kind of fraught, but if it makes sense from an energy policy perspective,
how long do you think it would take a new nuke to come online?
10 years.
Really? Yeah, we have. Do you know how many new nukes we have going through the approval process right now?
No. Do we have any
greenfield nukes? I think the number is zero. Uh-huh. But you know, so let's go through the approval process, and then once we even had full approvals, it would be a decade. Yeah. So I'm not, you know, yeah, it's not in my relevant time frame at all.
Fair enough.
Okay. And again, you know what I love about this? This is what we do at HX. Okay, so my whole mantra is this: I worked on Wall Street for 30 years. I ran billion-dollar hedge funds. You know, I'm one of the few, I'm probably the only newsletter writer that's managed over $1 billion. There might be a couple, I don't know. But the idea we had, Whitney Tilson and I had with Empire, was we wanted to take this access, this knowledge, the ability to get these ideas, and the kind of stuff that these billion-dollar hedge funds, I won't say they keep to themselves, but they're not going out there and sharing it. Like they want to keep it for their fun. We're going out there and sharing it with our readers. And to me, like I could go to any number of hedge funds right now and be managing a bunch of money, you know, be making very good money, probably more than I'm making right now. But I actually enjoy bringing this to investors. And I think it's cool. It's like I get emails all the time from our readers that are like, hey, thank you for this idea. I was able to do this, that, and the other. And this is it. This idea came from me from a buddy who actually was one of the top ranked analysts for years and worked at one of the biggest utility hedge funds of all time. You're not going to find, they're not talking about this on CNBC. They might be talking on CNBC soon after we're done with it. But you know, this is why HX exists, to give you ideas that are big ideas that either are consistent or big and that you won't be finding anywhere else.
Yeah. And that's a good way to close. Tell us how people can find out more about this and take advantage.
Daily.hxresearch.net is our main site. That's where you can subscribe to our free daily. You'll also see a way there to either subscribe to the free version of our paid newsletters, the two trading ones, Trader and Income, and our long-term one, Legacy. The free version of that, you basically get teasers on what we're doing there. Or you can actually go on the website. There's multiple opportunities to go and subscribe, for a lifetime membership or any number of monthly memberships, et cetera. You can check us out on YouTube. We do some great interviews with folks, as well as we talk to readers a lot. We occasionally give out the free ideas. And then we're on all the socials, LinkedIn, Twitter. I'm going to be spinning up my Instagram here another week or so. But check us out on social. And, I just want to say thanks for the support. This isn't a business. This is literally my life. My kid the other day, my 10-year-old came to me and goes, "Daddy, did you just put up a new YouTube video?" Now he wants to start a YouTube channel. I'm going to help him. I go, "Yeah, I did." He goes, "Yeah, I was the first viewer." I think he would just happen because he's on YouTube all the time. Right. So this is personal. It's not just business. So we appreciate the support.
Cool. Yeah, of course. Very cool. And you're not doing the Punk magazine anymore?
So it was Rock and Roll. I'm still on the board of that company, which owns a number of media. It's really an e-commerce company, but I actually run a vinyl record plant down in Miami, Florida, which we took out of that business. So if anyone here wants to get any vinyl records made too, give me a call.
So they actually make vinyl records.
We literally actually make vinyl records. We have 5 presses. You take PVC plastic, you turn it into these plastic pucks, you put it in the machine, and you press the records. I've got over here on the wall, I've got all kinds of records that we pressed. So nice.
Very cool. All right, then. Well, that is a great way to close. Enrique Abeta, thank you again for coming on the Contrarian Investor Podcast. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back here again next week or the week thereafter. Otherwise, on the daily. See you there. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.